Well, hey, everybody. Brian here with Canines on Duty with another Canine Mind Freak episode. And of course, my comrade here. Huh?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. Today's topic is brought to you by my vape, not by COVID, just so you all know.
Hey, so Ryan and I have been talking for a couple weeks. So we used to do a podcast every week. I think we're down to every other week to maybe once a month. And that's simply because we're getting into some really deep-rooted conversations. And we talk an awful lot about one particular topic so that we understand it to the best of our ability. It doesn't mean that we're 100% right on everything that we interpret from the sciences, but we're doing our best to make an impact, a positive impact on the industry to bring everybody to a greater place of understanding. So we spend a lot of time hashing this out, doing our homework, then discussing it. And it's just very involved. And today, a topic that has been come up recently, multiple different times with multiple different people, is consistency. So Ryan, if I may, give everybody the backstory and what triggered this conversation. So yeah, I'm working with a client at their home, and they have a rescued pit bull, and the rescue is not 100% truthful on some of the behaviors that this dog exhibits. Like, the dog is not being aggressive, but it's so excited to see people. It does the nipping, and it's breaking skin because it doesn't realize how hard it's nipping. Now, this dog has been neglected. It was starved at one point, like really emaciated. So now the dog, it has like this food obsession, right? So it's food problem. It's the nipping problem. It's the overexcitement. And in the beginning, they didn't see these behaviors. It took the dog to get comfortable. Well, then they have kids in college. The parents are both working. And so I did the first in-home and I said, this is what you need to do. You need, when the dog is doing A, B, C, and D, this is how you handle this. So they called me back for another appointment because they said the dog's doing great, better outside, but we're still struggling inside. And so I asked them about their consistency, and it brought up a big question. How do we be consistent when there's too many things that happen in everyday life? And my question—
Can I read the note that I wrote about this?
Yeah, go ahead.
You must set up training evolutions rather than try to monitor in real time and everyday life.
Yes, bingo. And that's it. And that's the question I pose to these people. When's the next time your cell phone's gonna ring? And I waited for an answer and they said, I have no idea. I said, see, there's an unexpected variable that can distract your mind from your dog. So don't try to deal with your dog problems in real time with real life happening with all these variables that just pop up. Do you know the next time somebody's going to ring your doorbell? No. Do you know when your kids are going to pop in all of a sudden with three of their college friends and decide they want to eat? And now all of a sudden you got to stop work and stop doing laundry if you're doing laundry or mowing the lawn. And then you got to make food for four college kids. Well, guess what? You're not paying attention to. You're not paying attention to the dog. And she's like, yes. So how do I do that? And I said, well, it's easy. You have to set the training. Basically, you have to do an experiment. An experiment is controlled and you're manipulating the variables, but you have an expectation. If I manipulate this variable, chances are I'm going to see this behavior. So then you're prepared for that. It's the same thing. So in this case, the dog was stealing food off the counter. So I showed them how to set food up on the counter. Don't command the dog to take the food, but entice them to put their paws up on the counter.
Tell everybody what was said about where the food was placed on the counter.
Well, the food was out of habit. The people were placing the food. You got to remember, this is an actual pit bull. Pit bulls don't normally get up to 60, 70, 80 pounds. Pit bull by breed typically is 40 pounds and under. If it's mixed with American Bully, that's where the weight goes up. So this is an actual full-blooded pit bull, meaning it's smaller in stature. He's only about maybe, I would say, 40 to 50 pounds. He's really stocky and muscular. So maybe he weighs a little bit more, but he's the appropriate size for a pit bull, which means when they put their paws on this 34 to 36 inch high countertop, his nose barely breaches the edge of it. So there's no way this dog could steal food if the food was a foot away from the edge. The dog would have to figure out how to literally jump up on the counter. So I knew, in seeing the dog put his paws on the counter, I knew that they were in the habit of putting their food on the edge of the counter. But they weren't.
Didn't they, when you pointed this out to them, didn't they come up with a bunch of excuses or an excuse as to why they didn't change that?
It really just boiled down.
They said it was out of habit we do this.
Correct. Yes.
So we're just going to keep doing it.
Yes. And that's the funny thing. And it's not that these people are bad people. They're actually super awesome people. I love these people. They got good heads on their shoulders. They want to do the right thing. But that goes to prove that life can cause so much stress and anxiety that we get to a place where we can't think simple and logical sometimes. I mean, that was a simple, logical solution. Just push the food back a foot to the back of where the backsplash is. Then the dog can't reach it. But because their life goes 100 miles an hour, they're like, he keeps stealing food. They were so focused on the fact that he was stealing food, they couldn't stop their brain.
And push the food back.
It was too complex for them with all the stressors that they have. So even though it was so simple, and some people might be like, well, they're not very smart. It's not about intelligence. It's about how stress and chaos makes us overlook some of the simple things, right?
Can I offer a term for that?
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Situational management.
Yes. That's a really good term. Absolutely. So how do we slow our brains down to manage? Well, that's a good question. It takes a lot of work because now I'm trying to educate another human being on how to change the thing that they've been doing for the last 20 years, every day, 7 days a week. I got to somehow change that for the sake of the dog. That's very hard to do. But that's where understanding the psychology of belief, the psychology of stress, and how that changes your ability to think clearly and to modify some of the simple things. This is why I believe that we need a separation when we're beginning training a troubled dog. You have to separate real life and set up a training regimen, or basically setting the dog up for failure. But now you're in a mindset where you can pay attention to the dog breaking the rules. And now you're prepared to offer either a corrective measure or praise at the appropriate time, because now you're focused on that one thing, the dog, because you set up, if the dog's stealing food, then put food on the counter. And now you say, well, I set that food up on the counter and I'm here with him. So if I see it, I can provide what you recommended to correct the behavior.
So in other words, to dumb it down for those of us knuckle draggers, you must create training time.
Bingo. Period. Bingo.
You have to sit, there has to be, whether it's 30 seconds, 30 minutes, or 3 hours, you must block off time in order to deal with the dog and nothing else.
Correct. Period. Yes. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, how many handlers call me and they're like, you know, I was trying to fix this during our last deployment. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why are you trying to work with the dog on a live deployment? Shouldn't you be setting training aside for that? Well, my department, we're so busy, we're shorthanded. They're not giving me my training hours. Okay, but you have a responsibility, a big responsibility.
So it doesn't got to happen in your off time hours.
Bingo. But so many police officers and even military personnel are programmed with the idea that if my agency doesn't give it to me, that I'm not doing it. Well, who ends up paying the price? The people in the society that you're protecting. Because if your dog misses a firearm, and that firearm gets used in a drive-by shooting, how many children die from a drive-by? Like, this is a big deal, and people aren't really thinking about the consequences of inappropriate training times. Mm-hmm. You know, setting up these
comments that one in particular, a personal friend of mine in Louisiana, I asked him, I was at his house one day, and I asked him, how many sustainment training hours do you, or how many times do you do sustainment training per week? And he said, the fuck is that? And I said, where you do practice with your dog, you know, on detection and whatever. He was like, we don't. I said, what do you mean you don't? He said, well, every year we recertify. Hmm. I said, you don't sustain train your dog? Like, you don't practice with your dog? He was like, no. And I thought, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, why is that important? Let's look at heroin, for example. If you have a detection dog, we know statistically speaking that darn near 80% of all street heroin picked up off of either dealers or purchasers is only 20% pure heroin. Oh, and there's a reason why.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's cut like crazy.
It is cut like crazy.
It's picked on by six different people along the line.
Yeah. For those of you that don't know how this works, mostly use non-military and police people watching, here's how it works. Majority of the heroin comes from Pakistan, right? The heroin fields. So it comes here in a pure version, like off the ship, and it goes to a distribution hub. A lot of your distribution hubs, there's one in like Dallas, Texas, any city that has ports. So you got Florida, you got up near Maine, in between Canada and Maine. So we have these almost pure things coming in, and then they go to these distribution hubs, and the distributors step on it, meaning they cut it up and then they mix it to double their profits.
So they use things like baby formula powder,
yep,
talcum powder,
fentanyl,
salt, fentanyl. Well, fentanyl is a whole other thing, but
right,
they use all kinds of stuff.
Brick dust.
Cut it and extend it. Yeah. They will, yep, sweep up dust off of a garage floor and put it in there.
Yes. Yeah.
So the problem is, which Brian was about to get to, I think, and I'm just going to throw it out there because I'm turning, is if you're not sustained training your dog and your dog is only dealing with the heroin, let's say from a particular distributor in your area, so he becomes, he or she becomes accustomed to that particular stepped on heroin.
Right.
Now, someone drives through from another state, you pull them over and they've got heroin that's been cut six different ways than what your heroin is cut. Your dog could fucking walk the heroin.
That's right. What if, so here's a great example. Let's break it down a little bit further. Let's say in your area, all the dealers are stepping on the heroin with talc powder or like baby powder. Mm-hmm. And it's 80% of that is baby powder. Only 20% is heroin. So the baby powder is the strongest scent. And if the dog consistently is smelling the stronger scent, think about how we started training a detection dog. You take a ball.
Now trained to alert on baby powder.
Yes, because the dog will always take the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. So how can we guarantee? You know, there's a lot of trainers that disagree with pseudo. I don't think you should train solely on pseudo, but because pseudo smells like the pure uncut version, or it's supposed to, then we remove the extra things that they're putting into it. So it's a way of maintaining the idea that this is what you're hitting on, not the more powerful substance that's in that. So if right, you're consistently using street heroin in your area, whatever they're stepping on it, there is a 50-50 chance that your dog will say, well, I always smell baby powder. It's always stronger than heroin. I know what heroin is, but this is linked to the heroin. So now you take somebody who literally has a baby and they're coming back from Walmart and they have four things of baby powder. Is it possible the dog will hit on that? Of course it is. This is why
I was watching a video not long ago This happened somewhere here in Florida. I want to say it was in Jacksonville. A particular set of drug dealers and distributors had started incorporating powdered rust into their product. And they did it so much that the dogs began alerting on every bit of rust in a vehicle.
Yep.
So every time the dog alerted on rust and they pulled the vehicle, they did a search and found, oh my God, this is rust. Now faith in the dog is gone, faith in the handler is gone. And the district attorney has said, no more. I'm not taking cases from you. You're done.
Yep.
And it's all because they didn't do sustained training on the closest thing to pure odor that they could get.
Correct. And if you look at the science of this, Ryan, it really makes sense. But yet you'll have people that want to battle this idea over and over and over again. But think about it from your perspective. How many times, as a human, how many times do we know what is the right choice, but yet we don't make that decision? We make the wrong choice. We do it all the time. Why? Because there are other things that are overpowering in your mind. And then so you make this decision and it turns out to be the wrong decision. And only then do you realize, man, I shouldn't have listened to so-and-so. I shouldn't have done this. There was more information being shot at me from the people in my social group that actually opposed this idea. I should not have listened to them. I should have went with my gut and did that. But we didn't do that. We do that all the time because we're humans. We're flawed through and through. So why is it so hard to think that a dog can't do that same thing? If you're using the same amount that has a more powerful odor that is not illegal, which is why I don't agree with solely training on pseudo either. There are trainers that only use pseudo. I don't agree with that either. In fact, I had a DA, multiple DAs tell me, but you're training the dog to detect a legal substance. You don't need a license to buy pseudo narcotics or explosives. You don't. So technically speaking, and I can articulate in court that you only train the dog, even though it smells like the real deal, you only train your dog on something that is in fact legal. Now, if you can show me that you're using a good combination of both pseudo narcotics and real narcotics, then we can articulate that this dog is well versed in both.
Now, you generally don't have as much of that kind of court entanglement with explosive detection teams, but you potentially could.
Sure.
You know, like when I was working at the Superdome in New Orleans, you know, if Yokai had alerted to a vehicle and I raised the flag and now they shut down the Superdome and there's 80,000 pissed off people. And let's say that there was something in the vehicle. There was an IED or an explosive. And there's obviously going to be a federal case that comes out of it against the person. Am I going to end up testifying? You're damn skippy I am, because they're going to want to know how did my dog do this and what is my protocol in order to get my dog to do it.
Right.
So if I've only worked on pseudo, which I hate using the word pseudo, but for lack of better verbiage and not taking an hour here, I'm going to use it. If I've only trained my dog on pseudo, a defense attorney could pick that apart.
Right.
So, and this is one of the things I'm so thankful for about the canine school I went to, is that the dog, we worked both. Absolutely. Every day we worked both. So that is in my favor. But people that only work real, and the same thing can happen with explosives that happens with narcotics.
Right.
If they're not stored properly, they can get altered. Matter of fact, you take, for example, like RDX or TNT. It's made here in the States a certain way. But if you take your dog to South Africa and run it on theirs, chances are your dog's not going to indicate on it because it's made differently.
Right.
So it is extremely beneficial to train on both.
Right. And consistently. I mean, that's ultimately the topic of discussion today, is trying to find a way to be consistent in your training. Well, in order to be consistent, that means you have to have an understanding of the bigger picture. Because if you're looking at everything with this tiny little lens, as we talk about all the time, You're not looking at all the other things that could affect the dog behavior. So then the consistency that you are using is flawed by nature, right? By the very nature of looking through this tiny little lens at only just a couple variables instead of all the life experiences, like getting a phone call. You know, I recently had a handler get a hold of me and say, my dog has been performing well. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, it didn't perform well. Well, then I find out that this dude is pulling double shifts. He's starting to have some issues with relationships. He's stressed. And so when I said, let me ask you this, the day your dog wasn't performing good, how were you feeling emotionally? And he said, oh, geez, let me try to remember. Well, I've been under a lot of stress lately. He didn't really go into detail. I don't need the detail. He just said the magic words. I've been stressed lately. So if body language is subconscious, meaning you don't know that you're giving micro expressions, we know from Dr. Stanley Coren, Michelle Mann, and a bunch of other scientists, Monique Udell, Clive Wine, Nicole Dory, Monique Udell, Alexandra Horwitz, I could go on and on. They all know, all these scientists know that dogs are experts at reading human body language. The dog knows when you're stressed. The dog knows when you're sick. The dog knows when you're tired. The dog knows when you're happy, when you're loving, because of that ability to read body language better than our closest primate, the chimpanzee. So why are we not taking into account that your behavior was not consistent because you were driven by emotions? If you don't have consistency, think about this. When you're happy and everything's going right in the world, your dog is working smoothly and better. The moment your life as the human gets disruptive, we all wear our hearts on our sleeve. And the dog notices our behavioral change, but they're not as smart as we are. For crying out loud, half the humans out there, including me, like I have abandonment issues, right? Because of my past. Which makes me believe something about others. I'm working through this now with my therapist through VA, but there's times my wife, who I know for certain loves me and treats me differently than anyone else I've ever been in a relationship with. I know she loves me, but there's times her facial expression triggers me. Just an expression. Well, who taught my brain that that facial expression means something bad? And do I have to internalize it and say it's all my fault? That's what a person with abandonment issues, that's what we do. Well, if I just take the blame, whether I did it or not, at least it'll be peaceful and all the stress will go away. It'll make them happy to shut them up. I started doing that with my wife and she said, I don't want you to do that. I want you to be authentic. What are you thinking and feeling? Well, that facial expression, it really made me feel weird. Well, I didn't mean to give you a facial expression. I didn't sleep good the night before. Or I've been working a lot and things aren't going well at work because of just normal work things. Not that, you know, whatever the case may be, it's not that your job is at stake. It's just that work can be stressful. So if she's got that on her plate, is she really in control of her facial expressions if her mind is already filled with stress? No, that's not an indication of anything that I have done. It's just an indication that her condition is stress. But people with an abandonment issues like myself, we take it on. Well, I must be stupid. I must not be thinking right. It's all my fault. No, that's not true.
I'm gonna chime in here with this because I think this applies to some of the police officers that are going to watch this. I have a thing. I'm working on it, and it's really, really hard. To work on this, but I'm trying. But I have a thing with my wife where the instant I feel like she is, quote, cross-examining me, my hackles go up and I go, what? Why are you asking that? Why? That's not important. Don't ask that. I become defensive immediately because of having been picked apart by superiors in the past, having been picked apart by defense attorneys, having been picked apart by district attorneys, been picked apart by my NCOs in the Corps.
Parents.
Absolutely. And it automatically, it's not that my wife is not picking me apart. It's just that in my experience, those types of questions are probing questions.
Right.
She's not probing.
She's just trying to understand.
Yes, but to me, it's probing, and I immediately come up with it. No. So there's a way that I think maybe some cops, you know, their day could go to shit that quickly if they have the same problem that I do. And maybe it happens before work. Now they go to work with their dog, and they're in a shit mood.
Yep.
So you're right. There is more than one way that this cat is skinned, so to speak, because we all have our little trigger. So you've got to be very cognizant of your trigger.
Right. Now think about this. We're the more intellectual species, right? Compared to dogs. I don't know a single dog that invented a car or a supercomputer. That's us. We humans did that. Mm-hmm. So we're light years more intellectual than a dog, but yet we still struggle with things. And then we say it's an impossibility that the dog is reading into it like that. But what we know is that a fully grown dog has all the emotions of a 2 to a 2.5 year old child, not intellect, but the emotions. So they can feel love, they can feel jealousy, anger, things like that. In fact, I have the article that you and I were going over the other day, right here. The study of dog behavior in historical perspectives. The behavior of dogs was very important in early history of comparative psychology. Darwin, back in 1871, he wrote this. He said, he wrote extensively about dog behavior, intelligence, and emotions, often using his own dog as examples. He believed that dogs had emotions such as love, fear, shame, and rage, as well as dreams and the ability to imitate and reason. Darwin also commented on how domestication impacted the behavior of domestic dogs, decreasing their fear of humans, and even argued for the evolution of distinct barks with various meanings. This is why I don't agree with the wolf pack mentality, too. And we've known this since 1871. Darwin's neighbor, down Sir John Lubbock, was one of the first to carry out experimental tests of the intelligence of dogs. In the first recorded experiment on non-human language abilities, Lubbock trained his dog Vaughn to bring him a card labeled food by reinforcing this response with the presentation of bread and milk upon retrieval. Once Van could readily discriminate between the food card and the blank card, Lubbock added more cards containing words such as out, bone, water, and tea, and reinforcing their retrieval with the action or item on the card. Although his data were, by his own admission, preliminary at best, Lubbock reported that out of 113 card retrievals, Vaughn selected the food card 80 times and the tea card 31 times. Since the dog consumed these items with alacrity, did I say that word right? Thank you. Yeah. Lubbock concluded that the dog had learned to communicate his wants effectively, and that's Lubbock, 1889. Vaughn's success inspired Lubbock's to attempt to use this method to test dogs' color discrimination abilities, as well as its ability to count, but no results were published. And of course, this is very thick. This just goes on and on, and it's fine print. There is a lot of information here. But the point is, we have known for almost 150 years that dogs have emotions. And if you have an emotion, then we have to look at the emotional contagion, the transfer of emotion from one person to another. Isn't it true that when you are around a stressed out person, you feel stressed?
If you are connected to that person emotionally.
Correct. Yes. So why is it so difficult for us to understand that if you do not have consistent, pleasurable behavior with your dog, that the dog will be triggered because of your stress and your anxiety, they will feel stress and anxiety. And we all know stress and anxiety prevented my client from determining that all they had to do was push the plate of food back 7 inches and the problem would be solved. The dog would fail every time it tries to grab the food because it couldn't reach it. But stress and anxiety prevented them from seeing something so simple. And yet we want to argue the point that dogs are driven by emotions the same way we are. And their emotions can be impacted by the way that we behave around them. And I could give you tons of research. We don't have time for that because I'm trying to keep these, you know, from being 2 hours long. But there's tons of research out there proving that exact same point, that the dog will be triggered based on the human's response, even if it has nothing to do with the dog. Just being stressed out around your dog will stress the dog out. We've seen this through multiple different pieces of research. And so when we talk about consistency, yes, we're trying to fix your dog problems in real time in your normal chaotic life, that's an impossibility. That's why you have to set up training scenarios that trigger the real life behaviors in a controlled environment. But then we also need to investigate, what about consistency in our emotions to the point of lying to our dog? I feel horrible today on the inside, but outside it's all blah, da, 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 bah. We're going to have fun. It's all a big party, right? This is going to be great. No, we don't do that. Instead, we say, no, I have the right to express my emotions. And we're not consciously aware that it's having such a profound impact on our dog and it's affecting their workability.
Yeah.
You know, when I was teaching tactical firearms, one of the last shoots with the last 20 or 50 rounds that we did, or maybe it was 100, we'd have a table set up in the field and I had tape. I tape off squares and each person has their square to keep all their ammo and their magazines and whatever else, right? Well, I would say load 7 rounds. I would pick an odd number one time, an even number, because I wanted to see if they were counting their rounds to know when to reload. And I'd have them run. The table intentionally was 100 yards away from the 10-yard line or 7-yard line because I wanted them to run, because you get that heart pumping to stress shooting, you know, closest thing to real life when your adrenaline's pumping. When they were loading, I would say, faster, faster. You're not fast enough. Come on, what's the matter with you? And I'd start pounding the table and their ammo is jumping up in the air and it's coming out of the containers and it's falling on the ground. Now, these people, when it was calm, I timed most of them. The mean average for loading a magazine was roughly 50 seconds, right? That was the mean average. Some people took a minute and a half because their fingers and the round kept slipping over the other one. They didn't know how to do it correctly or whatnot. So I just took the average, 55 seconds. When I was causing stress, it was taking 5 minutes to load that same magazine because I was incorporating stress and anxiety. So what they were proficient at with a calm mind, they were not proficient at with a stressed out mind.
And I keep hearing in my grape up here, this Marine Corps mantra, slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
Yes, they were trying to teach us, don't focus on this. Don't worry about the combat stress. Don't think about your buddy who was shot and killed, or don't worry about this, whatever else you experience. You focus on loading your magazine. That's it. You clear your mind, and that's all you do. They literally taught us how to manage our stress, which is why us military personnel might be better than some at suppressing those emotions. That I know specifically in the Marine Corps, how many times did you hear, get your bearing thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bearing.
I thought my name was Thing for 4 years.
Yeah, so did I, dude. Or shit sandwich. You know, that was a big one. Get your weird bearing, one. Turd. Yeah.
Did you ever get called weird one?
I don't think I ever. You know what? I did, actually. I did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You'd never think that such a grade school insult could cut so deep. Yeah.
Well, it was different for me. I knew I was going to go on to like I don't know, be a sniper or recon or whatnot. So my view of boot camp was, this is just a stepping stone. If I embrace this, they're going to make me strong. So like, they'd be thrashing somebody where they're doing push-ups to the point of pissing their pants or puking all over the ground. And they would be like, well, recruit so-and-so can't keep up. Who's going to take their place? I was always the first one there. I'm like, sir, recruit Gagey, we'll step in and take recruit so-and-so's place. And they're like, fine, get down and start pushing. And I would just push and push and push to the point where I'm just locked. I can't go, but I refuse to go down. And finally, Sergeant Coleman, he was like, you like this shit, don't you, Gagey? And I said, sir, yes, sir. And he's like, get up, get out of here. I'm not going to give you what you want. And they would not thrash me after that. And that's when they called me the weird one. Mm. The only time I got thrashed in boot camp after that was when the whole platoon got thrashed together, because they knew I liked it. But my mindset was like, it's not that I loved it. Who likes doing push-ups until you can't move or till you puke? No one. But I just thought, well, it's going to be a lot worse training for recon or snipers, so let's embrace it. But that's the only time I got called the weird one.
I didn't volunteer for shit like you did.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a glutton for punishment.
You're a weird one. That's why. I wanted to chime in here. I wrote a note yesterday.
Yeah.
When we were talking about this stuff. Roman soldiers. You brought up the Roman soldiers.
Yes.
That handled sometimes, you know, 8 to 10 working dogs per soldier.
Yep.
And the question that we discussed with ourselves was, how did these guys handle 8 dogs at a time when we deal with people regularly who can't handle 1?
Yeah.
And I did some research last night. I was not able to find anything yet that is definitive answer to this, but I did find some, what's the word I'm looking for? Some circumstantial evidence in some archaeological finds.
Nice.
That these Roman soldiers did in fact keep their dogs in their house with them.
Bonding.
They did not live in a kennel and be taken care of by strangers. They were the sole responsibility of the handler.
Interesting. So,
that is very interesting to me and to you. And it should be to everybody who is handling a working dog, first off, but also everybody who has a pet, because there is the bonding has to be there. It has to.
That's right.
Point blank, you're not going to get results without that.
Now, keep in mind too. Yes. Yeah. Now, keep in mind that I think this is an important detail. If you look at the history of those Roman soldiers, those war dogs, on average, weighed between 100 and 110 pounds. This dude, one guy, when he goes to combat, he is handling 8 to 10 dogs. That is 800 to 1,000 pounds of living, breathing, biting things. Imagine if that Roman soldier trained the dog to attack with compulsion training and all 8 of them decided, I don't like the leash pressure, I'm going to bite this guy. Well, then you have 110-pound dog feeding another 110-pound dog. And remember the emotional contagion. Nope, we're done with this abuse. You're just not getting attacked by one dog. You're getting attacked by 5 to 8 of them or 10. Mm-hmm. Then handler wouldn't survive. So how did they do it? Well, you just found, I didn't even know that. That's a piece of research I hadn't even found. I didn't know that the Roman centurions lived with those dogs to bond with them.
What they found were like encampments and in old Roman towns, they found items that were definitely attributed to Roman soldiers, legionnaires, or whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
Well, in some of these areas, they found a mix of animal bones that had cut marks, which is indicative of human beings using tools. Mm-hmm. And they also found bone fragments that had canine tooth marks.
Hmm.
So they went, well, the dogs must have lived here, and the guy, the human, must have been feeding them the same things that he was eating.
Yeah.
So you extrapolate from that, the dogs lived with the humans. Yep. And the human took care of the dogs. So there, and you have in its most basic form, the bond.
Let me ask you this. When they did the archaeological dig to discover this, how many clickers did they find?
Fucking zero. Zero clickers, bro.
Ah, that's funny. That's funny. Yeah.
So yeah, that's extremely interesting to me. Extremely interesting.
Yeah, I heard another, I think it was a scientist who researches the canine world. And he said, I think it was Genghis Khan who trained 80 war elephants to cross the Alps?
Wait a minute. Was it him? I believe it was him, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Don't quote me on that for you listeners. But there, I think it was Genghis Khan. We're talking centuries ago, trained 80 war elephants to cross the Alps. How did they train that? How did they train all 80 elephants to do what they did? Or how did the Roman soldiers actually train their dogs? They didn't have clickers back then, but yet they did a very good job. Well, I believe they took it from paying attention to humans. I noticed when I complimented this person and gave them a pat on the back, they were more willing to do something for me. What if I do that with this animal? I don't know. They didn't have official training academies like we have now. They literally figured this out through watching human beings and saying, I wonder if it'll work. I don't know. Let me try it. I think that's why those Romans, when the archaeologists dug it up, found that. I do believe that they were living in their home because of the bond. And we just read what Darwin said back in 1871, that he believed that dogs had the emotions of love and jealousy and hatred and, you know, the basic emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't they want to bond with us? There's so many people in this industry trying to steal the emotions away from the dogs, but yet we need to know that in order to understand where the behavior comes from. I just had this conversation with somebody about aggression, and I said, what are the two circumstances in which aggression is actually used for? There's only two. It's either self-preservation because they feel like they're in danger, or killing food. It's actually designed as a primary function, safety and security, which equals food, but that's it. So if a dog is being aggressive, it means that it believes it's in danger, or it needs the food. That's where food aggression comes from. I need to have this food. I didn't have it at one point. And if you take it from me, I'll probably die. That's the belief that's in the dog's head, which equates to the aggression. In my new psychology book that I'm always referencing, it talks about how two opposing emotions cannot exist simultaneously. So you can't have aggression when there is a true sense of love and compassion. If I was like, hey, Ryan, I just want to tell you that since you and I have got to know each other, you're one of my closest friends, and I really appreciate that. Would you turn around and punch me in the face?
No.
No, because two opposing emotions can't exist at the same time. You can't love somebody and pull a pistol and rob them at the same time. You can't do it. If you are in a place of peace, you cannot have anxiety to exist in the same moment. If you are anxious, you can't have peace because those are conflicting emotions. So whatever you're putting your mind to, that's the emotions you're going to get. So if you're living in your past, like I've been doing for so long with the whole fear of abandonment, then that means if I'm assuming that even like my wife or my kids are abandoning me or giving me the impression that they might, I'm just reliving my past that I can't rewrite. I can't change. I can't go back and do nothing. So why the hell am I going to sit there and live in the past? All that's going to do is take away my success for the future.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in sniper school, we were up on this ridge line. And it was so cool. We had been up for about 4 days. We hadn't eaten. We're hallucinating. I mean, I'm talking to a freaking bush. My partner is grabbing me and throwing me on the ground because there was a little riverbed cliff about this deep. And he thought I was walking off a big cliff. But I wasn't. It was only about 6 inches, but his mind was hallucinating. So what we would do is, in order to accomplish our mission, he would take 15 minutes only to take a quick 15-minute nap. I would stand watch. And then vice versa. He would stand watch for me and give me 15 minutes. So it was only 30 minutes of our time. It was a great way to compensate, right? Mm-hmm. So he's sleeping and I'm on top of this ridge line and I'm just in awe. It's a super clear night. We're at Camp Pendleton. I could see all the way from Camp Pendleton to Oceanside, California. That's how high up we were. I could see all the lights and I thought, man, how beautiful is that? And then my brain started thinking, I was in such awe over the scene that I was watching. I'm like, this is beautiful. How I have taken this beauty of this world and I have perverted it based on my past experiences. And I started feeling guilt and shame for just not taking the time to witness the beauty of what is out there in the world, right? And this saying popped into my head. Those who focus on the wrongs done in the past have no vision of the rights that they can accomplish in their future. Because you are constantly in this revolution of focusing on everything in your past that you cannot change. You can only change the next 5 minutes. You can only change the rest of that day. What I just said 5 minutes ago is erased. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
So I'm going to put this in that dumbed down.
Please do.
It's an analogy. So your brake lights and your headlights.
Mm.
Your headlights focus and show you what's ahead. Your brake lights dimly illuminate what's behind.
Yep.
Which is more important.
Yeah. Yep. And this, Ryan, I love that analogy, by the way. That's beautiful. I'm going to use that because this has a direct impact on our ability to have consistency in our training. Piece of advice for you handlers out there, or even your pet dog people that are listening, set up your phone. We have all this technology. Record you interacting with your dog in a training regimen or wherever your dog's ill behaviors are. So if 60% of the time your dog is working good and 40% of the time your dog is not, the first thing to rule out is you. So set a phone up, watch your mannerisms and your behavior and your verbal tones when your dog is working good during the 60 percentile time, and then compare that to the 40%. If you're in the same location, then the dog already knows what all the distractions are. So we can rule out those distractions because you're in a contained place where you can control the stimulus or the variables in the environment. Now, if you're in the same location and a stray dog that your dog has never seen came up, then yeah, you could see a shift in behavior. I'm talking about you get into a controlled environment where you know all the variables. Then you take a look at your body language and compare that to the dog's body language. And then ask yourself the question, if you saw a subtle difference, then you have to ask, why did I change that? Okay, well, what happened that morning before you started training? Did you have a fight with your spouse? Did you just learn that you're indebted to the IRS and now you owe them 20 grand because of a mistake? Like what's going on here? That's the only way you're going to determine whether or not you are being consistent or if it's something else that is causing the problem. Mm-hmm. But we have to start somewhere, right? So that's my suggestion to people. And that's what I've been telling handlers that get a hold of me to do.
You know, I liken that to what I learned over my years of riding and working on my motorcycles. Anytime that there is an issue, you start with the simplest thing first. You roll out the simplest and work your way to the most complex.
Yep.
That way, you're not overcomplicating it from the beginning. Same deal. You just described it. Mm-hmm. The simplest variable to identify is yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But then we got to worry about that thing called ego, because there is a certain number of people that refuse to think that they are the source of any dog problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not true, folks. You must look at yourself in the mirror and determine whether or not you're part of the catalyst that creates a negative behavior in your dog. Start there. And if you can honestly rule yourself out, then and only then will you know that it is something else. And because you've listened enough to Ryan and I, you now know, don't look at the behavior. Look at everything that possibly attributes to that behavior. What variables are out there? You know, when I had my kennels, every time I worked with a dog, I had a profile form. So let's say it was just a civilian's dog. There was a questionnaire. How does your dog react to men, women, and children? Has your dog ever shown you any signs of aggression? Does your dog growl? If so, when? Because I want to know, is it a guarding growl? Is it an aggressive growl? Or is it a play growl? Or is it just a simple frustration? So
I'm going to give you a term here that you can use to describe this kind of thing in the future.
Yeah.
The parachute. If you're going to jump out of a perfectly good airplane, do you only worry about the silk in the parachute?
No.
You have to worry about every line. You have to worry about every buckle. You have to worry about every stitch of fabric in your harness. You have to worry about your wind speed. You have to worry about your altitude. You can't focus on only one part of it. You must focus on everything.
Right. Yes. Yep. And that's what I was doing. And I wanted to look at the data. So, when you have 1,000 of these notes and at the top, they tell me what their behavioral is they're struggling with, then I can pull every file for 10 years. And I was training on average somewhere between 300 and 500 dogs a year, consistently for close to a decade, right? So I had thousands of these forms that, and then I would just pull out possible aggression. This is what the dog was doing. And then I would go through all the other files and pick the files that were the exact same. Then I logged the owner was doing this to combat the behavioral issue. And then I compared that with all the other people. And what I found, the people were pretty consistent. They were dealing with their aggressive dog like a spoiled child. So some of them were spanking the dog. Some of them were kenneling the dog for timeouts. And really what they were telling me was how I discipline my human child is how I'm disciplining my dog. But yet it wasn't working because a dog is a wild domesticated animal. It's not a human being. They have the emotions of a 2 to 2.5 year old child, but they can't interpret data the same way a 2 and 2.5 year old child does.
Right.
No different than a chimpanzee.
The reason that we do.
Right. Yeah. It's no different than a chimpanzee seeing the world different than a dog or a bird or an alligator. Right. It's that's the big difference. So I would see this constantly and I would say, do you know that all your dog problems, the reason why you're not fixing it is because you're not looking at how you're handling the problem. You believe because of what you've been told to deal with this. Like, for example, the whole, and you listeners, you've heard me say this 1,000 times, but look at the idea of treat-based only training. What do we know scientifically? If there are high levels of cortisol, which is the stress hormone, it shuts down digestion. That's why you don't want to eat when you're stressed. You know, when you get that little ball in your stomach, that's because your intestines are squeezing, forcing the oxygenated blood out to the extremities. That's why when you're under severe stress and panic, you feel diuretic and you are not hungry. So if a dog is in a state of fear and anxiety, you're trying to stuff food in their mouth and they're like, I don't want it. So what good is that tool if the dog is rejecting it? It's not good. But yet there's so many people that will hold on to this concept as if they're on a rope hanging out of a helicopter. And if they let go, they're going to plummet to their death. Right. But it's based on a lie. It's not true. It's not accurate information because of the science of cortisol. Had I never learned about the powerful impact of cortisol, I would not know that treat only based training is a fraud. It's a lie. It has to be.
Understanding a little bit of the proper roots of things, the term correction. We talked about this yesterday. Correction is the wrong fucking term.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up.
Consequence. not correction. It is consequence.
Yes.
Could you do you have handy the definitions of correction?
Yes, I do actually. And then I'll share my invented definition of correction, which I developed about, I think it was 15 years ago. All right, let me pull this up. I got it right here. Okay. So according to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, there are four definitions of correction. So number one, the action or an instant of correcting, such as correcting an amendment or rectification, rebuke or punishment. I like this one. C, a bringing into conformity with a standard. Then D, neutralization or counteraction. That's an important one too. Then number two has nothing to do with behavior. It's a decline in market price or business activity following and counteracting a rise, something substituted in place of what is wrong. That's a good one. A quantity applied by the way of correcting, as for adjustments of an instrument. The treatment and rehabilitation of offenders through a program involving penal custody, parole, and probation. Also, the administration of such treatment as a matter of public policy, usually used in the plural. But the whole point is, let's look at the main ones that really apply to psychology. Something substituted in place of what is wrong, or bringing into conformity with a standard. So my brain thought of this. How do human beings associate correction? Well, we've all had our hands smacked. We've all been spanked. I think most of us have been spanked at some point in our life. And so to us, correction is something that equals pain to make you not want to do the behavior that caused the pain. But that's a twisted way of thinking, because the truth is, I agree with you, we should change the word correction to consequence, because consequence can either be good or bad. Now, a person that truly understands the definition of correction, meaning it could be good or bad, like the definition said, it could be punishment or it could just be prodding someone to change their decision to go in to the conformity of the social environment. But how else can you do that? You can do it with praise. That's positive reinforcement. Because the definition said to get somebody to conform to the standards. It doesn't say how you conform them. That is a corrective measure. So praise can be a corrective measure. If the dog is doing something bad and you give him a jolt, that's one way. The dog says, well, that sucks. But then also, if I want to train the dog to do a sit and I give him a pat on the head, love reinforcement, am I still getting the dog to conform to my desires? Yeah. So technically speaking, now I understand this is very philosophical, but that would comply with the definition of correction. I think the human condition is that we associate correction with pain and suffering. That's why I want to get rid of using the word correction, because almost 90% of the people that I ask, what in your mind, what is correction? They say, well, it's something that is painful that makes somebody change their mind about doing something. And I said, that's where you're wrong. It's about interrupting the thalamus, which means it doesn't have to be painful. You just have to find a level that triggers what the thalamus does. The thalamus pays attention to a stimulus in the environment. You know, Dr. Bruce Lipton says it like this. Let's say you're a caveman and you have a bacteria infection. Your thalamus kicks in and says, you're going to die from this bacteria infection unless I tell the rest of the parts of the brain to send all your energy to the immune system to battle the bacteria infection. That's why you're tired when you get sick. It's because of your thalamus in the brain. This is true with dogs. But then all of a sudden you're getting chased by a saber-toothed tiger who's going to eat you for lunch. Guess what your thalamus does? It says, we need to pause the bacteria infection, because if you get eaten, it doesn't matter if you have a bacteria infection. And it literally pulls the energy away from your immune system and puts it to your arms and legs. It sends that information to the motor cortex and it makes you run away. And then you're, once the tiger stops chasing you, then your brain says, okay, cool, we avoided that. Now let's get back to feeling really tired. So, because we're going to push all your energy back to fighting this bacteria infection. Right? So that's what a consequence does, whether it's a positive consequence or a negative one. It makes the entity think about what they just did. Did it work out well for me or did it not work out well for me? We have to remember the definition of learned helplessness too. I use that to my advantage all the time, because the definition of learned helplessness is a sense of powerlessness derived from a traumatic event or a persistent failure to succeed. Sometimes my training is no correction given by me. And what I mean by this case is a tug with the leash. Let's say I have a dog and I'm actually working with a client right now. Her dog wants to attack other dogs. So I said, put him in a down and stand on the leash and ignore him. You stand there for the next hour, because I'm trying to induce learned helplessness. So I'm not the one tugging on the leash. Every time the dog lunges, he's tugging himself. Therefore, the dog associates the act of lunging with something that he created himself. Because I'm not up here doing this. He didn't see this. I'm standing on the leash. And you let him try and try and try. And we hope that in the majority of the dogs, they go into learned helplessness, which almost all of them do. Man, I've been trying to attack this other dog for the last 10 minutes and I'm not getting anywhere. And that's when we see him just quit. That could be considered a consequence. The consequence is you can try and try, but I'm going to remove all your problem-solving abilities. Now what do you have? There's only one option left, and that's to sit there and shut your mouth and get love and affection. Mm-hmm. Your call. I don't mind going back to ignore you for the next hour. But when you finally shut up, I'm going to take a knee and just love the snot out of you. So go ahead.
You have the negative consequence of the dog yanking itself, going into learned helplessness.
Yep.
And then immediately you provide a positive consequence.
Right.
So there you have it. It's not so much a correction, but it is consequences to the action.
Correct. Yes. Yep. And then again, that boils down into consistency. If I take that exact same dog and every single time I let him try and try and try only to find failure, he'll give up in time. But then the next day he's rejuvenated. He had sleep. He forgot, whatever the case may be. I do it again. And after about, of course, every dog is different. Some dogs you do it 10 times and they get it. So other dogs, you got to do it 5,000 times before they get it. But either way, if I am consistent, and I don't give into impatience, because that's what happens. I've done this 20 times. Why are you not getting it? And that's where they go to ripping the dog's head off, because now the dog doesn't even want to think about attacking, but now the dog has fear of the handler or the leash. Leash sensitivity, where does it come from? An experience of somebody mishandling the leash.
Yeah.
So, all right. I got to jump off here, because I got a few phone calls. I think that, Ryan, this has been an amazing discussion for me. You?
Me too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've really got
to this, because we had, what, 4 2-hour long conversations that led into today?
Yeah.
So that was pretty awesome.
It was awesome. And I think it's a very, very important topic. So if you're listening, and you want to know more about things that we're talking about, I put together this dog psychology course. It's 4.5 hours. It's affordable. There's no reason why you shouldn't take it. If you're listening to this and you're like, man, I didn't know that about the thalamus, or I didn't know that about emotions, you don't know what you don't know. I put this class together and I made it affordable to prod people to take it. Now, listen. It's not my information. I'm a good teacher. So I'm good at taking a piece of science, breaking it down into layman's terms to my layman's terms. Ryan is a good co-host because he breaks it down even further from his perspective. It's all, we have a great dynamic here. We put all this information in this one course so that you can know what is actually happening behind the scenes of the mind. Without that, you're spinning your wheels. You don't know truth from a lie. So you could be led astray because you don't know the knowledge. I just had a cop call me this morning who bought the class and took it last night. And he's like, dude, that was so profound. He's been a cop for 8 years. He's trying to be a canine handler. And he's like, I asked some of the other handlers certain questions. They couldn't give me an answer. But your class gave me all the answers. Now I don't even have a dog and I feel like I know more than them and they've been to school. That's why this class exists, folks. So don't hesitate to take the class. Yes, I never wanted to be a pushy salesman and I'm trying not to be, but I know the value in this class, right? Without the knowledge, we're just guessing. Well, if you truly love your dogs, I mean, do you really want to guess with people that you love and it could equal life or death? No. Why are we doing that with our dogs? Get educated. That class is there for you. I'll post a link. So you just click on the link, you can purchase it, and you could be watching it tonight if you want to or over this weekend. So take a look at that and see if it's right for you. I guarantee you it is. You need to know this information. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in and for your consistent support. I really appreciate all the supporting comments that both Ryan and I have gotten over the last 6 months. We really appreciate that. That's our positive reinforcement to keep bringing this content to you, because our podcast is free. We don't get paid for this, folks. We're doing this because we love dogs and we love people. And we want to see humans treat dogs better. So our intentions are good and the information is good. It comes from all scientific research and professors and scientists that I have talked to and interviewed in order to get the information to build this class. So it's all straight from the horse's mouth. It's nothing I created. I'm just regurgitating the knowledge all in one place. You don't have to do 15 years of research and sit with a piece of research this thick with a dictionary to figure out what the heck they're saying. I've already done that homework for you. That's what I get paid to do. I've done the homework for you. You just got to learn. That's it. So that's available to you. Please use that as a resource after you take the class. And this is for anybody. Feel free to text me, call me, ask me questions, call Ryan, ask him some questions. If he doesn't know, he's going to say, call Brian. And if I don't know, and I know Ryan knows, I'll tell you to call Ryan. Ryan's area of expertise and what motivates him to research is scent detection stuff. He's light years above me. I can interpret the behavior of scent detection, but I don't know like eddy currents and all this other, the transition of molecules and I don't know that stuff, but Ryan does. And Ryan has talked to the scientists, specifically like Michelle Mann from the Department of Defense, who her primary focus of research is olfactory senses. You talk to her how often? Probably once a month?
No, yeah, minimum once or twice a month.
Yeah.
And they're always fairly long conversations. Just to give an idea of what some of the things Michelle and I talk about, I reached out to her recently and said, hey, what do you think is the chances a dog can detect a meteorite? And we had a long discussion about that over the course of 2 days.
That's awesome.
Because I went, I wonder, because I saw a guy on television who claimed a dog could do it. And my brain went, could this be real or is he full of shit? So I started diving into it, reached out to her. We had a great conversation about it. Those are the kinds of things that grab my attention.
Yeah.
And make me learn and learn and learn.
Yep. Well, and that's why we have such.
I don't know everything.
Right. Of course. Neither do I. Neither do I.
I'm learning. I'm continuously learning and expanding my horizon on that.
Yep. Well, and we have to. The moment we think we know everything is the moment we stop doing justice for any of you listening.
Yeah.
The moment we think we got it all figured out, we are lying to you. And I refuse to do that.
Me too.
Yep. So we respect you all that much that we want to make sure that we stay in the place of reality. And the reality is we don't know everything. We really don't. But we're trying to improve your life and we're trying to improve your dog's life. So until next time, stay safe, watch your six, and as always, Semper Fi. All right, folks, take care.
Be safe.